All right, welcome to Market Call. It is Wednesday, March 13th. I'm Dan. That's Liz. You guys know her as EY from SoFi. Guy Adami will be joining us in just a few short minutes.
It'd be nice of him to show up on time.
Yeah.
He should get his commute all right
in one car or something. No, that's not going to work here today. We got a lot to do today. We're going to take your questions as we do on Wednesdays. Liz has to bug out. She's got a little dental issue. Just saying, you know what I mean?
But I don't care.
It hopefully won't affect your commentary a little bit. I will say, look at that little trailing ticker there. See that? Leave us a question in the live chat and we will answer them. So that's going to happen in the second half of the hour. Guy and I will do that. So get those questions in there. Liz, let's talk a little about this market. It's kind of interesting. Guy and I yesterday mentioned the fact that, you know, the S&P on the year, okay, now outperforming the NASDAQ 100. That's not something I probably had on my bingo card a little bit. But let's go to the rundown really quickly because we're going to talk about this. It maybe is a sign of the broadening out of this rally, which has been unabated since late October or so. Really interesting call, a couple dueling calls in the auto space. EV euphoria is dead. I think that was a CNBC headline. So we're going to talk about an upgrade of Ford and GM at Morgan Stanley, a downgrade of Tesla at Wells Fargo. And obviously we're going to take your questions. We're also going to preview Liz's note that will drop on the SoFi investing blog tomorrow morning, but we get a preview today. You're going to be talking about some records that you see in the market. You're going to put some context in around those. So let's do that. All right, Liz, let's talk about this broadening out here. I'm looking at my screens. I see the S&P is, let's look at the S&P chart here for a second. The S&P just holds that uptrend, as Guy would say, like a boss. And
is that what he would say?
Yeah, he would say that. And he might have the opportunity to say it, I don't know, in a half a second or so.
All right, so
thanks for joining us.
Oh,
it's about time.
So one of
the
many
starts at one.
Yeah, I do know that. So there are many reasons we're doomed as a society. I think we all agree. Maybe, okay, you know what? You don't have to agree with me on this.
Well, as a society or a people? Those are two very different things.
You know, it's fair you say that.
Yeah.
As a people.
As a species.
And one of those reasons is we don't trust our eyes anymore.
No.
Unless our
phone,
our application, you have to... The application tells you to take this route. You got to take that route.
So which route did he take you?
So we are in 45. What am I dexing people when I say that?
Yeah, we don't have to do these.
45. Amanda's losing her mind
already. You get here late. She's losing her mind.
We're somewhere Flatiron-ish.
Yeah, we're
45 West 18th Street. Now, people that are familiar with New York City, we're basically halfway between the Lincoln Tunnel, which connects New Jersey and Midtown Manhattan, across through underneath the Hudson River,
correct,
and the Holland Tunnel, named after the great country Holland, which connects, again, the aforementioned New Jersey with Lower Manhattan. Now, it stands to reason that, you know, you want to avoid Midtown at any cost, especially on a Wednesday, that's today, because today is the day that all the people go to the shows for, what do they call it?
Matinee.
Of course, we come in through the Lincoln Tunnel, which was an abject effing disaster. Anyway, I'm here. How are you?
Hey, Guy. How are you?
Market call. 1 o'clock on the East Coast.
All right, so first, we have a little housekeeping to do.
Yeah, please.
Last night on CNBC's Fast Money,
EY
from SoFi got a shout out.
I did.
Yeah.
It was really cool.
Kind.
It was cool. I wasn't watching at the time. I got a text message
from me,
from Guy Adami, said, shout out on Fast Money. So I turn on my TV. Yeah. I rewind to this so-called shout out. I did get a shout out for my yield curve chart,
which we're going to talk about. Which was accurate.
I brought that today. Yeah. We're going to get to that.
But
also got a little bit of shade thrown my way about being on a different show. Yeah. And
she does every program on the network but ours. And I didn't mean it as shade. It's just factually true.
See. Okay.
You know, you're a member of the HTR.
That's true.
Here we are. So it is an interesting day.
And you heard us as you were walking in late.
And I apologize.
You and I were we were talking about it yesterday a little bit. It's not too frequently in the last few years that we could remember that the S&P has outperformed the NASDAQ 100.
Today's one of those days.
And today is one of those days. And I'm looking at my screen, Liz, okay? And I see a block of red. I have my fact set screen organized in a way where I have different subsectors in the markets, that sort of thing. You can see it right here, right? You see that?
I use it
as like a little heat map guy. You probably have done that yourself. All the semis are down, okay? Our friend NVIDIA down 2.5%. I think it was down 3.5% before. But there's a lot of green on my screen, which is leaving the S&P dead flat on the day, while the NASDAQ, though, because it's being driven by a bunch of those big semi names, and Apple is also down. Not too many days that we can recall also where NVIDIA and Apple have been down together the last couple of weeks. What's your take on this? So we have a NASDAQ 100 that's up about 7.5% of the year. We have an S&P that's up 8.5%. Both pretty great, but they might be telling us something about the performance in the market.
Well, I mean, there's this big rotation going on, and I'm gonna call out our friend Doug Cass. Mm. Doug, I hope you're not upset that I'm going to tell this story.
Uh-oh.
But I was on Closing Bell, CNBC's Closing Bell on Monday, and talked a little bit about just the market strength that's been going on. And I answered a question in the form of something along the lines, near term, I am optimistic. Let me clarify. And Doug and I had an email exchange on this, because after the show, Doug sent me a message and said, you got to tell me why you're optimistic, right? I don't think much has changed. Absolutely fair point. Here's what's different, and here's what's happening. I don't even know that it's all that much different. It just continues to prove itself that even when there are little pullbacks in the spots where we've had overexuberance, we've had, whether you want it to be Mag 7, even if it's just NVIDIA, the little pullbacks that we have, people still come in and they rotate within risk assets. They don't take their money out of the equity market. They are being stubborn about risk appetite. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but it's just the reality. Risk appetite right now is stubborn. It is sticky, and the optimism is sticky. So even in the face of some of the stuff that probably should be scaring people, some of which we'll talk about today, it doesn't seem to shake them enough to shake people out of the equity market. So what I think we're seeing, and why the return pattern has been much different this year, maybe more even than last year, is because I don't think anybody would argue that by the end of last year, maybe by the end of January this year, that mega cap tech was overvalued, that there were some pretty obviously crowded trades in those spaces, particularly semiconductors. But people just looked for other ways to find growth and other ways to find upside. So that's where the rotation is coming from. Are there fundamentals to support all of those? Perhaps not, but it's happening. And that's what's, I think, driving a lot of this evening out in the returns.
And I think just as we're sitting here speaking, there was a 30-year bond auction, which is, I'm looking at my Twitter machine, and Rick Santelli gave it a grade of an A. So apparently, to the extent that you're seeing moves in the bond market, and the S&P is probably flat now, I think it's on the back of this 30-year bond auction, Dan.
Yeah, so we have the 10-year at 417. Well, why don't we just do this? Why don't we get to that tweet, the aforementioned tweet that you were talking about last night on CNBC's Fast Money. So tomorrow morning, if you want Liz's weekly report in your email box on Thursday mornings, you can go to SoFi.com/blog and you can have that report put into your email box. But Liz, you're talking about some records in the markets, and I thought this was really interesting. I think Guy was referencing the distance or the length of time that the 210 spread has been inverted, but you have a couple other ones you're looking to focus on tomorrow.
Yep, and these are records. These are not all-time high records. We've already talked about those enough, so we're going to focus on some other stuff. So the 210s, it just so happens, a couple days ago surpassed its record for the longest inversion of all time. It used to be held by that period between 1978 and 1980. We have now passed it. This is the second day past it. And this is something that has carried much debate over the last year, year and a half, because we've got people saying this is different. The yield curve doesn't signal recession anymore. That signal doesn't work. It's broken. I don't know that we have the verdict on that yet. I'm going to say that we don't have the verdict because it hasn't re-steepened. It hasn't hit zero. But this is certainly something to note. And if nothing else, it's sending completely contradictory messages than much of the economic data or much of the narrative around the fact that the economy is strong and everything is okay. So, I mean, I would say every time, but it's not necessarily every time. But every time that you have an inversion that's this deep and this long, there has been a recession that followed. I recognize that there have been some very brief and shallow inversions that have not resulted in a recession, but this deep and this long, it would be the first time that we didn't have one afterwards. And I think this is something to pay attention to.
Why do you think, okay, I agree with you. Why do you think we've pushed past, not we, but collectively the market seems to have forgotten all about it? And sometime in January, it seems is when the market stopped talking about this inversion. Maybe it's because it got to what, about 11 or 12 basis points or so. I think that was sort of as steep as it got, the inversion as steep as it got. But here we are back to like 40 basis points ish, depending on where things are at this exact second. Why do you think people have just forgotten or don't seem to care about it anymore?
I mean, it's sentiment, obviously, because it's a contradictory signal. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying, oh yeah, that's right, that's still out there, it's sending us a warning sign, you have to explain it away by saying it just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't mean anything because interest rates have been manipulated for such a long time that it doesn't work. I still think it does work. And just in its simplest form, what does a yield curve inversion really mean? So that means if the long-term yield is lower than the short-term yield, generally speaking, and of course there are exceptions to everything, but generally speaking, that would mean that people are expecting a somewhat deterioration in economic conditions over the next mid to long-term. That's not usually a good sign. How would we re-steepen? We would re-steepen by the 10-year going markedly up from here, but rates staying really high.
Mm-hmm.
That's also not necessarily a good thing. We have to withstand that for a long time. Or we re-steepen by the 2-year fall. Why would the 2-year fall? Because the Fed starts cutting rates. Then that's the debate that hasn't been answered either. Are they going to cut rates because they want to, because it's just going to be a more comfortable position for the economy? Or are they going to do it because they have to?
And I think that's the exact reason as to why the market seemingly doesn't care. Because what the bulls will say is, yeah, it's going to re-steepen in a good way because the Fed's going to be allowed to or able to lower rates because inflation is tame. The job market is still pretty robust. There's nothing to suggest they'll be lowering rates because something bad happened. I think in a nutshell, that's the bull case. And listen, maybe it plays out. And again, I hate the term, but maybe it is different this time. My pushback would be, I think it could be different this time. I actually think it can be worse. But, you know, again, it's half empty, half full stuff, Dan.
Yeah, no, and let's bring it back to the market because I think this next chart is kind of interesting, Liz, the consecutive days without an S&P 500 decline of 2%. Mm-hmm. And just think about that. On Friday afternoon, and Guy, you and I, we did not do a market call, but we were talking about the reversal that we saw in some of the biggest market leaders. And to see a 10% reversal in an NVIDIA, which is what, the third largest market cap company in the U.S. So you can do the math there, $230 billion, and have the S&P close down less than 1% is pretty amazing. But it does speak to what we started this out, is that we have financials, we have industrials, we have a whole host of other sectors, retail, that have kind of joined the party here. And, you know, each night we come on CNBC's Fast Money, Mel always looks over to me and says, you're still bearish, you know, this and that, whatever. And, you know, it doesn't make me less, I guess, skeptical or less bearish because I see new highs being made. Because if you can attach a bunch of the dots, like you were talking about, like one of the reasons why we still have this yield curve inversion, one of the perceptions or one of the main perceptions about future growth, like you just mentioned, that's one of the reasons why I'm not buying into it here. So Liz, when you see this chart, how is this record or this, you know, this period in time, which we have not had a 2% decline, how is that fitting into your narrative of the blog that you're reporting tomorrow?
Yep. So this blog, the theme of this blog is going to make Guy just absolutely
let's hear it boil.
So the title of it is The Longest Time.
That's a stop for a second. Billy Joel, apparently, Dan, and I'm sorry, it's like Thursday. I'm in one of those moods.
Yeah.
It's Wednesday. I know it's Wednesday. He sells out Madison Square Garden. Like, they have a big banner at MSG. Billy Joel, however.
Good Fish is up there. Fish has a banner. Fish with a PH.
Fish.
Yeah.
That's a group.
Jam band.
I know people like that for some reason. I don't like that at all.
And you know what? Fun fact. So Billy holds the record for most lifetime appearances and most consecutive appearances at MSG. He's playing his last show at MSG on July 25th.
Thank God. Did I say that out loud?
150th. I can't even believe I just said it. So I themed it after him.
Well, and I know that he has as many shitty songs, actually more shitty songs than good songs.
Yeah.
Without question.
You've said that on CNBC's Fast
Money. And I'm saying it here. Yeah. And I know Billy's a big fan. I'm sorry. It happens to be true. Please continue.
Billy happens to have a house in Sag Harbor too.
Yeah.
And
do you summer together?
No. I've actually never seen him, but if and when I do, Billy, we'll do a selfie in the grocery store or something.
Thank you.
Anyway, so it's called The Longest Time for obvious reasons. We're talking about these elongated periods. The section with the longest stretch, what's actually the second longest stretch, without a 2% correction is called You May Be Right. So I neglected to say I may be crazy.
Right.
Well, maybe I am. But this is towards the end of the note to say, okay, look, here are some of the warning signs, longest yield curve inversion. There's also a table in there that we can bring up in a minute. Basically, it's the second longest wait between the last hike and the first cut. So we're elongating that cycle as well. We're sitting here twiddling our thumbs. And the last part of it is, but the market hasn't seen a 2% correction since February of 2023. So that must mean something, right? And the part of it that
shocking. I'm just gonna tell
it
you.
Is shocking.
I'm like absolutely shocked. I've had a bad year trading, by the way, people. That is one indication.
No, it's
because like it just the lack of volatility to the downside and the slow grind up to the upside has been a killer. Mm-hmm. And it's been a killer, even if you're like long and you're long premium, it hasn't been particularly great in some of the wrong spaces, but
So I'll just read a quick passage. Rather than spending too much time dwelling on the signals that have proven to be concerning in the past, mm-hmm. we also must recognize what's happening in the present. One of those data points is this one. And I think you have to pay attention to it. There's people that will say, don't fight the tape. There's people that will say the market is never wrong. It's priced exactly how it should be at this moment. And that may be true. And obviously this is a testament to the resiliency and the buying appetite that's still out there. And it's one of those things that, you know, mid to late December, mm-hmm. as the rally continued, I started to say, you know what, let's just ride it. It doesn't mean it's rational, but ride it. If you want to make money, I don't think it's going to conk out soon. And that was in mid to late December. I think we're getting closer to conk out time now, but the momentum is there. And if you fight the momentum, you do it a lot of times at your own peril.
Agreed. 100%. And you were spot on, and you typically are. I'll say this. I love that. Here's what concerns me, and I'm sure it concerns you and Dan as well. It's great if you know like, okay, I've enjoyed this ride. I'm on this wave. I'm getting off. I'm going to sort of exit in the back end of the wave. Otherwise, as surfers know, this thing is going to crash on your head. So my concern all along has been unfounded, by the way, that when it does turn, nobody's going to see it coming and they're not going to be able to get out because it's going to paralyze people. So my continued warnings are to your point, and I have not said this, Elizabeth said it, enjoy it while it lasts. And it's been a great run. And I think, I don't know if we have that tweet from, I think it's the Kobayashi letter. I don't know if I pronounced that right.
Look at that. There you go, guy.
So if you look at this, and Apoll just doubled down, and Apoll said this, I think a week or a couple weeks ago, about this bubble that's being created. And I don't know if you can full screen that tweet so people can read it for themselves if they don't want to hear my voice. But you know, this is not Guy Adami saying this. I mean, this is a storied institution saying things that, again, you don't have to agree with, but you absolutely have to take into consideration. So 3 weeks ago, they said the current bubble is bigger than the 1990s tech bubble. They gave you valuations. They compared it to 2000. So
all right, listen.
Again, enjoy it while it lasts, people. That's my point.
I mean, we've been making this point. I mean, like, you know, people like, oh, you've been on the wrong side. Like,
yeah.
Yesterday we did like a really what I thought was a great trade idea for NVIDIA longs. Listen here, people, we're not your stockbroker. We're not your, you know, hedge fund manager, this and that, whatever. We show up every day. We're kind of calling it like we see it. We're trying to kind of lend our expertise where it can be helpful, that sort of thing. I'm sorry if you think some of our bearish commentary has kept you out of certain stories. I will remind you this, that, you know, last year with a stock like NVIDIA, I mean, it spent 6 months. It spent 6 months, okay, consolidating between $400 and $500. On January 5th, I went on national TV. How many of you guys go on national TV and try to make a call and do that sort of thing, okay? Like, I'm just telling you, it can be hard here, people, okay? But I went on there when the stock was $490. And I said, I would get long this thing, you know, using options. That's what I do for the most part, because it looks like it's going to break out in an epic sort of way. I reiterated that on Market Call, that sort of thing. So, you know, at some point when the stock goes from 500 to 600 to 700, whatever. Yeah, man. You know what I mean? Like before that earnings print, it was trading at $670 or so. We did the same thing, a collar trade. Every time you think about how you're going to manage risk in an investment or a trade, and you want to use something like options to help do that, you have to give up something to get something. That's the whole point. So yesterday we did a collar trade, taking advantage, okay, again, if you're long, of the skew and the options premium. The calls are bid much higher than that of the puts. It's giving you an opportunity to participate more to the upside, but getting, you know, much closer protection to the downside. That's smart stuff. If you're here for that, If you want to learn that sort of stuff, great. If you want to just join the peanut gallery and just throw haymakers around, this, fine too. But, you know, just understand that we have a mission here and we're going to stick with it.
No, I mean, as much as it would appear as though we're not trying, we actually are trying to help people.
Sure. Because
we've seen certain things before.
And to your point, though, okay, in 2 months, that stock has gained $1 trillion in market cap. That's not normal. Going back to that Apollo situation, when it comes undone, it will overshoot to the downside. I can assure you, just like it overshot to the upside. And what we know, again and again and again, being this close to retail investors, and Guy, you've been doing CNBC for 17 years. I've been doing it for almost 15 years now. We meet with hundreds or thousands over the years of retail investors. They make really bad mistakes at highs, and no one knows it's a high. And they make really bad mistakes at lows, and they don't know it's a low. That's why they're making those mistakes. So, you know, we're just trying to keep things right down the middle, Liz, a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and your stamina on the upside is much stronger than it is on the downside. As soon as it starts falling, people get scared and you cross over those mental thresholds, depending on what your entry point was. First, it's down 10% in your account. Then you open, it's down 20%, and you start to panic. And it's like, you don't want to see that 30% number. And people usually sell as it's falling and lose a lot of the gains that they had been excited about. I think the important point, though, of what Dan just said, it's not always a bearish call. It's a risk management call. Yeah. And the other piece of this is that people that maybe had been lucky enough to be exposed to the seven stocks that went up last year, if you're just holding those through that period and not buying anything else to broaden out your portfolio, I'm willing to bet that you're overly concentrated in a handful of names. And the risk management piece of it is making sure that you're managing your positions, managing your own concentration, so that if the market does turn around, you're not exposed to it six ways to Sunday.
Yeah. All right. Let's look really quickly again. You know, we're almost done with the Mag 7. Seriously, people, we are almost done with the Mag 7 very soon. It literally will just be the Fab 4. I just want to hit the S&P again. You've seen the trend line. We're going to keep putting it up there because, Guy, at some point, we're going to have a down day that goes through that trend line, and then we will be breaking Liz's record on that S&P 500. It's going to happen. Here's one that I think is really interesting, Guy. This is the one-year anniversary of the SVB collapse here. Let's pull up the XLF here. And again, doesn't look too different than that S&P chart. But I wanted to highlight a couple names that are near and dear. Well, one of them's near and dear to your heart, because I think you didn't start your career at Goldman Sachs, but you spent a good part of your career there. And Morgan Stanley also. So two investment banks. We spend a lot of time talking about these large money center banks who've moved big into investment banking and a whole host of other products. But when people think of Goldman and Morgan, they think of, okay, when's the capital markets business coming back? When's the IPO cycles? When's M&A and that sort of thing? And so it's interesting. Let's pull up Morgan Stanley today, which is having a good day. Guy, I don't know about you. We keep getting asked the question, if the market is so good, if we have these string of highs, where are all the IPOs? And we're starting to see the filings. We're seeing Reddit. There's a whole host of others that have kind of announced that they plan to do it. But if you can't bring them soon when the markets are highs, and let's say we do have a pullback, then you get the headline pulled for market reasons or the conditions in this or whatever. So it's interesting that Morgan Stanley has really been stuck in the mud here. Let's pull up a Goldman Sachs. On a relative basis, has acted much better than Morgan Stanley, Guy. Look at the consolidation there after that breakout to new 52-week highs. That's not something you see in a stock market that's making new highs every day for the last month.
So let's pull up a Goldman Sachs. That is a shorter term. If we could do a longer term chart, like a five-year chart, I want to illustrate a few different things, because we actually have talked about this a number of times. Back in, I think, the summer of 2022, the stock traded down to about 275 or so, and then obviously bounced. Then if you look October, like many things, and there's the chart, you can see it for your eyes, we traded down to similar levels and bounced. So here we are. We're getting very close to a prior all-time high, which I want to say was probably the fall of 2021. We traded north of $400. So this is doing the grind. It looks really good. Those bottoms are in place. But you know, you're getting towards levels where I think this will exhaust itself as well. And if you do a shorter term chart, going back to the prior one, you'll see good news is the stock is trading really well. The bad news is now there are a couple of unfilled gaps to the downside. So what I think is going to happen here, in my opinion, you know, we'll push towards those prior all-time highs. I think it exhausts itself. And then I think we have a reversion to the mean like we've seen before in the form of the moving average. And if you don't believe me, look at your eyes right there. You see the number of times that this stock mean reverts. And I think that's we're probably on the precipice.
Yeah. So Liz, thoughts maybe again, investment banks versus money centers. And basically you see that beautiful 45 degree angle that the XLF has been in. Thoughts on financials in this yield environment, that yield curve inversion and the like here, and what the Fed is likely to do next?
Well, we're going to find out what the Fed is going to do next Wednesday, which is going to be a big week. Yeah. But so the thing about financials is we've had all of this conversation around regional banks and the commercial real estate risks that are out there. So those are the risks we know. Those are the things, those are like the black swans that are going to come out and really not be black swans because we're aware of them. And that continues. None of that has been solved yet. And obviously just the things that have happened with New York Community Bank further reinforce that regional banks perhaps are not out of the woods yet. And then you transfer over to the banks that were the winners of that crisis, which are the big banks, the ones that took on all of the people that were worried about things being a crisis situation, and smaller banks. That ship has also sailed. So now we move on to, when are capital markets going to look like they should in early to mid-cycle behavior, if that is the case? I think this is another piece, and I get pushback on this a lot because I still think that we're late cycle. And Guy, actually, I think you would have some good talking points on this. The M&A activity that's happening right now, I think, is emblematic of late cycle behavior. We're seeing a pickup in M&A activity. We're seeing almost a clamoring for consolidation in some industries. And you're also getting pushback, right? And you're seeing prices that just don't really make sense for some of these acquisitions to be taking place because there's euphoria that has driven prices higher, and then M&A starting to happen to try to eliminate competition and strengthen a position, but it's all happening at pretty high prices. So I still think that that is emblematic of late cycle, in which case you actually do not want to own financials. You want to wait.
I agree with you. I do think it is late cycle. And I think one of the signs is going to be, again, my opinion, Dan, I'm sure has views. If you see companies use stock as currency, that's actually a sign as well, because what they're telling you effectively is, and this is not each and every time, but what they're saying is, we actually understand our stock is probably at elevated levels. We're going to use that to our advantage by making acquisitions using our stock, as opposed to other times in history where you might see mostly cash or half and half. So if it's all stock deals, again, it looks great on the surface, but I think that's a bit of a sign as well.
Yeah, and I guess, listen, we spent some time last month when Capital One made a bid for Discover Financial. And you know what? It's funny. A lot of people that we know who tend to be cynical about M&A and the like, there was a lot of really good reasons for that transaction, and it made sense. And I think that was largely an all stock transaction, to your point. And, you know, maybe the rate environment had something to do with that, you know, but a lot of these companies probably got their balance sheets in okay order, maybe not in the regional banking sector, but who knows? Listen, Liz, we know you're coming up against time. We are going to let you hasta la vista here.
We're two ships passing in the night.
We really are. I mean, and I'm just here.
You're like an anchor in the boat
in the middle here.
Before we, I know Elizabeth has to leave.
Yes.
Can you hold up what appears to be some sort of green concoction?
Yeah, this is the first one I've had it's a smoothie. It's a green smoothie from Juice Generation. I don't remember what it's called. Green Monster or something.
Actually, if Juice Generation sponsored us, I don't think either one of us would drink that. I gotta say,
I did not expect it to be good because of the ingredients, but
I bet if I had a guess, kale, spinach.
Yes, both. Collard greens.
Collard greens, of course.
Ginger in here.
Ginger is very good for you. Maybe a little turmeric.
Plant protein. I don't know about turmeric. Yeah. There was a long list of ingredients, and I expected it to be bitter. And it is. It's quite delicious, it's and I intend to buy more of them.
Okay.
All right, enjoy.
Yeah. I'm going to say before Liz is going to leave, the list was long and distinguished. Yeah. Now, for the first person to answer that,
An easy one.
Is it an easy
Top
one?
Top Gun.
Thank you. Elizabeth, you knew this?
I love Top Gun.
Yeah. Of course you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That volleyball Goose. Scene. No, it wasn't. Goose said that to Rick Rossovich, his response is.
Rick Rossovich. That should have been the bingo thing. All right, let's say goodbye to Liz.
Also, I have to mention this. Yeah. Top Gun starring Tom Cruise, who is exactly 20 years older than me. Same birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He's saying that right now.
I know.
Because he's watching. He's like, oh, my God.
You know who's kind of blowing up right now is this Glenn Powell, who played.
Love him.
Yeah. He's going to be the star of the next Maverick. Like, that's going to be very clear. Because the Miles Teller guy, you know, obviously it's going to be the two of them. But I think Glenn Powell is just kind of smoking Teller right now.
I like him. I think he's a great actor.
Guys, get your questions in. We got a couple more things to hit. I know, but we got a couple more things to hit before we get your questions. Liz Young, thanks. You guys can get her investing blog at thesofi.com/blog. Check it out today. Thanks a lot,
Why
Liz.
Wouldn't you?
All right, let's throw up this Dollar Tree chart here because we have, thanks, Liz. We have a headline here. Guy, this is one. You know, we've been talking a lot about retail. Retail is a sector confirming, right, at least some of the stuff that's going on in the markets, the kind of strength of the consumer, all this sort of stuff. You've actually been talking about Dollar Tree. I want to say for a couple of years now, we've been talking about this sort of trade down situation here. You know, this thing rallied as a lot of other retailers did over the last few months or so. But, you know, you see this move, this gap right down to that 200-day moving average. You see that it really has been in a downtrend, although it's been very volatile over the last year or so. What's your takeaway when you see this headline? It's probably not a huge surprise to you.
Well, it's not. No, it's not. And I'm not trying to be a wise guy. It's not a huge, because what we have been saying pretty consistently is there's a, you talk about this chasm between the have and the have nots that we brought. Just think about what Dollar Tree did today, what they said today, closing 1,000 stores. Think about their consumer. Think about where, you know, typically in bad times, people trade down to the dollar stores. And I'm not being, I'm not trying to be a jerk. I mean, that's just factually true. Mm-hmm. You have to ask yourself, if they're trading from Dollar Tree, where are they trading down to from the dollar stores? That should be concerning. Now, juxtapose that with, if you pull up a WSM, a Williams-Sonoma chart on the fly here, you'll see the complete other end of the spectrum. Yeah. Look at the move in WSM today. So on what this is, this illustrates everything we've been saying in a nutshell. Picture tells a thousand words. Williams-Sonoma off to the races. That's obviously one side of the spectrum of consumer. Dollar Tree obviously getting, you know, dragged down today. That's the other side. Which speaks to the reason why I think so many people are having a hard time in this economy, because, you know, they look at the stock market and say, wait a second, what am I missing here? And it's problematic. I mean, again, the consumer drives the economy, and the consumer, large part, is, you know, those consumers, the dollar gen, if they're seeing trouble, you know, if they're having difficulties, if the unemployment rate starts ticking up, I think at some point, this all finds its way into the market.
All right, do a 5-year of this wall, this Williams-Sonoma and
WSM.
This is pretty amazing, and I actually love the way you just framed that. It's really kind of interesting when you think about where the problems in the economy are going to happen. But the other thing I'd just say, you know, with the market is concerned, and I know that Williams-Sonoma is a name guy because you've talked about it. You guys have this little Dutch oven thing you do on the Fast Money, you, Tim, and Mel. This has been a stock that is traded below the market multiple and many of its peers for a long time, okay? And even in that parabolic, so look at that breakout. It's epic. Now let's go back to the one-year chart, okay? And you look at just kind of where it was and where it is right now, and the idea that you would buy this stock in front of that print,
right?
You know what I mean? Like after the move that it's had, and then the sort of reaction that it has to that, again, you know, this is a low single digits earnings and sales grower trading at 19 times below a market multiple. This is what's so hard, I think, about trading this market right now and investing in it.
And I think, again, we're not you're not saying this, and I'm not saying this. We brought it up just to illustrate a point. We're not saying you go out and run and buy Williams-Sonoma today on this basically 20% move to the upside, having had a big move to the upside, because this is a day where it probably does exhaust itself in the very short term. We brought it up to sort of illustrate the difference between one side of the economic spectrum, one side of the consumer in the form of Dollar Tree, and the flip side in the form of Williams-Sonoma. And therein lies, I think, one of the large problems with this economy right now, and why people, generally speaking, are so upset just through the lens of the economy.
Well, all right. So let's do one last thing before we get to the questions, because this is something, Guy, it's kind of a similar sort of setup. So today you wake up, okay, and you see that Wells Fargo downgrades Tesla. They put a $125 price target. The street's getting really bearish on the name right now. The consensus for deliveries for Q1 is still up there at like 475,000. It was above 500,000, I think, just a couple months ago. This analyst, and I think Baird's analyst, and a guy that we've quoted, Troy Teslike, who tracks deliveries, are down at 420,000. So you might see some more downgrades until the street comes down as far as their delivery estimates, and then ultimately the full year delivery estimates. Let's just pull up a live chart for a second of the Teslas. And so what's interesting here, Guy, is that this kind of 170 level, I know it's one, if you got to go back to last April, May, where you get to, and then, you know, there's an air pocket down to 150. Fine, whatever. Okay, it's Tesla. The thing is broken. The story, the fundamentals have been, you know, getting worse and worse. We were drawing that downtrend line from the all-time highs in late 2021 literally there are 6 points on that downtrend that we've drawn, you know, to the penny, to the penny, to the penny, as Carter would say. So to us, the fundamental story appears to be getting worse. There's a price war. There's issues as it relates to China and this. And it goes on and on and on. And obviously Elon issues. All right. The flip side of that, guy, you wake up Adam Jonas over at Morgan Stanley, who's actually been a big Tesla bull throughout this whole move on the way down. He upgrades GM and Ford. Okay. So look at how these stocks have acted. They pulled back from their EV ambitions. Okay. And they're obviously at one point they're being punished for that, right? Because everyone was convinced that they're never going to be able to catch up to some of the competitors and Tesla and like, and now they're being rewarded for it. What the heck? I mean, like, that's just a weird situation. Then we have a chart, just GM versus Tesla. It's just pretty fascinating.
Well, on your basis. Over the last, over the last 6 months, it's pretty stark, right?
Yeah.
And if you, again, GM has its own issues without question. And if we put up a longer term, I love that chart. Let's pull up a GM chart over the last few years. I mean, you get up to $43 and it's been in this pretty tight range for the last year or so. You know, 43 sort of the higher end of the range. I want to say sort of 29. It actually traded a little bit lower than that, but basically 30, 43. You can see it right there. Yeah. You know what that actually looks like? Oddly enough, looks like the small cap in a much different way, in a much different time frame. But it looks exactly like the IWM in some way. So are we close to breaking out? If it gets to 43, we'll have a conversation. And maybe we are on the verge of something here in terms of GM without question. But the more interesting story to me continues to be Tesla. And if you put up that last chart, Amanda, real quick, you'll see. I mean, that downtrend, we flagged that downtrend for a long time. We talked about the pennant formation for a long time. We thought that the pennant would break to the downside for a long time. And if you really want to do the uptrend line, do it off those low points. And then if I'm going to sort of walk you through this, we actually broke through it, traded back up to it and failed. Not that one. The middle point there. I'm sorry. I apologize. I mean, I should be more that one. Now draw the uptrend line higher off those other lows and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. The point is, broke it to the downside, retested it, failed. Not good at all. So what comes into play now? You probably got to go back to that January low of about 113 or so. And that's got a bullseye on it.
If she wants to connect from the COVID low, you can just add another one to that low from last year. You know, you have another trend line that I think is kind of interesting too, you know, guys. So I think,
And now that, basis, so, okay. So where's the support?
You know, so
you're
basically talking 150 ish or something like that. 100 was that Jan 2022 low. And I got to say, I'm gonna make one point here. By the way, I started this week. I was really proud that on Monday, I didn't say the word Tesla or Elon once. And I got on the desk at Fast Money. I looked at Mel and I said, you know what, Mel, I'm not going to say Tesla or Elon once
this whole week.
Yeah, I did. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting about that is in December of 2021 into 2022, do you remember Tesla dropped like $100?
Yeah.
So like all of its gains or it was the end of 2022 into 2023, all of its gains last year were just kind of getting back that late December sort of thing. And then the fundamentals took hold. And I think the fundamentals are going to continue to deteriorate. All right. Well I just think that's a really interesting juxtaposition, though.
The move that people focus on is that move from basically 113-ish. To $300.
Yeah.
And they say, oh my God, it's been a monster. And that move in a snapshot was amazing. Of course, the problem is, as we've pointed out, this has been in a downtrend now for the last 3.5 years. And if you, not that I'm asking you to do this because I want to go to the questions, but just think about where the NASDAQ is, effectively all-time highs. Think about where Tesla is in relation to, and you know, over the course of that time, what the broader market's done. You talk about a stock that is vastly underperformed, it's Tesla. And if you didn't know what that was and you just looked at it, if you took the emotion out of it, you'd be like, holy shit, you know, you guys are actually right. Anyway, there you go.
Actually, no, but here's the thing. That's not even, we could reflect that a bit differently. But, you know, at the end of the day, this stock went into the S&P 500 at $232. Okay, it's trading at $171. And since then, the S&P is up like 35% or something like that. So massive underperformance. All
right, here we go.
If it's Wednesday, we take your call.
We're taking. I'm about to sneeze, so I apologize. Thomas Krupski is actually asking.
Bless you,
buddy. I told you about to sneeze.
You did.
Thoughts on the VIX? Okay. You know, we've mentioned a number of times, you know, Dan talks about this.
Well, Belsky on our Friday podcast. Brian Belsky from BMO. On the Friday On The Tape podcast, actually go check that out in your favorite podcast or other people, but go ahead, guys.
No, you know, and I've brought this up, I'm not certain the VIX is a good indicator of anything anymore. I'm pretty convinced for a number of different reasons, it's been dampened and sort of suppressed by external forces that I don't think people fully understand. I know I don't. I'll say this, you know, I do think there's a move in the VIX coming to a theater near you. I think people have gotten way too comfortable being short volatility in an environment where they're rewarded for it. And that's a great strategy until it's not. And when it blows up, all those gains you've enjoyed by being short volatility go away like this. So, you know, I look at the VIX and see it below 14. I get it. You know, I think there's a day of reckoning again coming for the market, and it's going to manifest itself in the VIX trading. If I really wanted to put a price target on, you know, that 34 level that we topped out at a couple times in 2022, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, Bloomberg had an article on March 10th. We'll put it in the show notes here. And it was titled, ready for this? One of the most infamous trades on Wall Street is roaring back. Billions pour into ETFs, selling options, yeah, and a huge bet on stock calm. So that's obviously, and we'll go, you know, this article goes into pretty good detail about how that trade went haywire in 2018. But the fact is tens of billions of dollars are being poured into these sorts of strategies, and they are vol dampening. And we go back to that record that Liz just showed us about how many 256 days without a 2% decline, it almost emboldens people to enter strategies, yep, like this. But when you're doing in a lot of these funky sort of structures, it has the potential to actually wreak some havoc if something goes wrong. So we'll put that in the show notes there, people. You can check it out. What else?
This is a great one. Wavy McFly. And actually, this sort of echoes some of the things we've talked about. What do you think about being long China, short Japan for the rest of this year? I love that idea. So let's start, if we can, by pulling up an FXI. So I think in mid-January or so on this show and on a couple of other shows, we talked about how the 21-ish level in the FXI was support. We can go back a couple of years and we can go all the way back to the financial crisis. And we showed it on a chart. That's actually held up. Now, with that said, the FXI has not been off to the races, but we're basically closing in on 25. I think this is a lot of room to the upside. On the flip side, the Nikkei traded up, I think it's 35-year prior high or so. Yeah. So if you want to pull up that chart, you'll see that, you know, there's a very good chance, in the same way we might have a double bottom here in the FXI, we might actually have a bit of a double top here in the Nikkei. So I actually think that's a great trade.
Double top going back decades.
Yeah, which is very powerful.
It is very powerful. I would just add one thing on the FXI, and I think we're really clear on this. It's like, when this was like, you know, this ETF was 22.5, that sort of thing was kind of muddling around a little bit. You see that kind of double bottom that you talked about, Guy. You see that downtrend. You just draw it with your eyes there a little bit. You don't even need to put it in there. You know, we said that 21's your stop. Like you don't want to be long it below that. If you want to back that chart out, maybe 20 years, if you can do that, you know, you say to yourself, listen, if something is going to cause this thing to make new lows from the financial crisis low and then lows when they were in the, you know, in the crapper, you know, all those years ago, you just don't want to be long it. So use that stop. Now, what I would say with the thing at 24.72 or something, you keep raising that stop.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, you know, and ultimately, you know, if there is a pullback, you will get stopped out, but you will at least protected a good part of your gains. And I'm with you on Japan.
We have a question about Triple M. Let me see who it's from. I think it's ENP. Could you talk about Triple M? Is it looking good now with the new CEO? So here's what I'll say about Triple M. If you think about some of these other industrials, some of these other sort of Rust Belt America companies, they've been off to the races. Triple M can't get out of its own way. Now, there'll be people that say, well, it's ripe to play catch up here. And maybe that's true. And you can make a case on valuation. Of course, the problem with that is you've been making the same case on valuation since it was a $200 stock. So I see the bounce. I get it. And maybe there's some room to the upside. And maybe in this environment, there'll be this reach for stocks that have underperformed. So, you know, you can keep this one on a tight leash, but there's a reason why. And a lot of it has to do with Triple M specific stuff. There's a reason why this stock has underperformed now for quite some time.
Yeah, that makes some sense to me. And again, like if we're in a market that is obviously, you know, broadening out and some stories are being given the benefit of the doubt, you could say, well, why not this one? It trades at 10 times, yada, yada. Listen, when you hear, you know, company specific sort of issues, like to fix those issues, it's not usually a 1 or 2 quarter thing. And there's a reason why some of these stocks stay in the penalty box. So this is not particularly interesting to me either.
Anthony Kerr has a question. We addressed it, but put it up. And what he's saying is, I've never seen mega caps behave like meme stocks. Is this a new thing now? What happens if inflation heats back up yet? With the AI, NVIDIA pumping consumers, credit cards, all time highs. When does it break? You know, Anthony, I appreciate that. This is all themes and other themes that we've been talking about for a while, and I'm concerned. I think credit card debt in this country is now $1.15 trillion. That's a record. I think consumer debt in aggregate is north of $17.5 trillion. That's a record. People say, you know what, it's offset by jobs and the fact that maybe wages are improving. Yeah, you can explain a lot of things away. The reality is people are fighting inflation with debt. That's the nuts and bolts of the whole thing. You can see it right before your eyes. And then you layer on the conversation we had about those consumer stocks. And yes, it's concerning. Has it manifested itself in the market? Clearly not. Is it just a matter of time? I've said for a while, yes, that's been incorrect, but it doesn't mean it'll be wrong.
Fair enough. All right, let's take a question here. This is on Square, guy. This would be, some call it Block. You will not
know
that.
No, I won't. It's Square.
Let's throw this one up here. Okay, you see that. I can't even read what his name is, but you guys see it on there.
Cozy Coconut 88, I believe.
Oh, wow. Look at you. Yeah. Want to see a stock breaking out? Look at Square from the weekly perspective going to 105. Hey, by the way, thank you. I do want to see a stock breaking out. Like, I appreciate you guys bringing up stuff to us. So we should probably try to do this a bit more often.
So if you look at a five-year chart,
yeah.
This obviously had a huge move to the downside. Yeah. You could start to look at this and say, okay, we're about to break those prior highs. Again, this looks like a lot of things we've been looking at. If you draw a horizontal line across, you'll see that this basically somewhere between 85 and 90 is a level that we've had difficulties at a number of times. So you can start, there you go. You can start making the case where you have these bearish to bullish reversals, and this might be one of them. So this is one where if you're long, I think you wait for a break of sort of 90-ish, and then I think you add to that long and start to play that. And then if you do have a stop in place, you start to raise that stop. So yeah, this could absolutely be one of those stocks, Dan.
It's funny, you know, like this stock when it was going parabolic in, 2020 and 2021, the whole idea was that this was like, this whole new form of payments and peer-to-peer payments and they own, the Cash App and all the stuff at point of sale and all this sort of stuff. You know, I look at this and I say to myself, this is like at best a 35% gross margin company. The revenue growth is expected to be like, let's call it 10, 11, 12% for the next few years or so. So it's not even a hyper growth company. This year is supposed to grow sales 14%, 12%, then 9% consecutively. And then I look on a GAAP basis, and you have to look at a company on like this that, they're literally just hit GAAP profitability last year. They made 2 cents, guy. Okay. This year expected to be $1.41, which places it about 26 and a half times earnings, 20 times next. So without margin expansion, without a case for faster revenues and better margins, it's just not that compelling of a story. And to be honest with you, I think Jack Dorsey, it's just not a great CEO. I know that he founded Twitter, but he ran Twitter into the ground. And then not only did he sell it for $44 billion, which should have been a mic drop, he actually rolled his equity. He rolled his equity into it at that price, which is just embarrassing if you think about it, because it's probably at best worth $15 billion. And then this company, since he's been the CEO in the last year and a half solely of Square, no longer of Twitter, like this thing can't really get out of its own way. I don't know. It's like sometimes you just got to move on. You know, a lot of you guys, you tweeted us and say, why are Dan and Guy, or maybe just me, Guy, why are they still on the show after all these years? Maybe it is time to just go every once in a while. Jack should probably go and maybe I'll go too.
Nah. Okay. Last one, JM460. Thoughts on Barrick Gold or miners in general, since they have not followed the move up in gold? We did a show yesterday, JM460. I don't know if you can go back and look at it, but you should, because we outlined actually a trade in the GDX and the mining stocks, and we gave you the reasons why we were bullish of the underlying commodity and the miners, and I think they still hold up. So, yes, the mining stocks have completely underperformed. If you think about it, the stock market's basically at an all-time high. Gold is basically at an all-time high, and some of these mining stocks are 50% of what they were at their all-time high. It doesn't really make a whole hell of a lot of sense. I think what it comes down to is, one, maybe they've been used as a source of funds in some way to get into crypto, maybe. Or in addition, I think a lot of people have been burned being long miners, thinking that gold was going to break out, because it hasn't happened. With that said, if you look at some of these stocks today, for example, like Agnico Eagle Mines, if you want to pull that up, comes out AEM, Amanda, if you want to sort of throw that up. That's up pretty significantly today. If you look at a chart over the last like week or so, I mean, this has had a little stealth rally from about 45 to 56 and change. So the mining stocks are starting to catch a bit here. I think personally, I think that's going to continue. I think they are going to play catch up.
You know, this was something that's kind of interesting to me. And, you know, Michael Saylor, who's the CEO of MicroStrategy, they keep doing these convert deals, raising money, selling equity in MicroStrategy and buying Bitcoin. Okay. And, you know, he's, you know, really all in. Okay. He made this point on CNBC the other morning. I thought it was really interesting. I mean, it's something that we've said often. And, you know, to me, the whole idea that cryptos are currencies, no one uses it to spend, it's a store of value, it's property. That's what Saylor was sort of saying. I can't opine on what he's doing with MicroStrategy. Like, I wouldn't buy MicroStrategy stock if I wanted exposure. You're getting levered exposure, right, to Bitcoin, but the premium that is trading relative to the Bitcoin that it owns doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, with the spot ETFs, there's a whole host of ways you can do it. You can obviously buy in the spot market, and you can own your own, you know, coins and this and that, whatever. But, you know, it's interesting, guy, as we were talking about this move in gold, 10% in the last month. So the global market cap of gold is like, what, 14 trillion? So you can do the math, right? $1.4 trillion that gold has gained, right? If it's up 10% in the last month. Look at Bitcoin that now has a $1.4 trillion market cap that's up 50%. In the last month. Okay. So you can do the math there. So that's gained, you know, 500, 600, 700 billion, you know, however you're looking at it or whatever. I think that's an interesting relationship there, guys. So if people say, well, why is gold lagging Bitcoin? Well, it's not really lagging Bitcoin. If anything, Bitcoin is probably taking some market share. Mm-hmm. In some ways, gold might have outperformed Bitcoin during that move. Does that make any sense
a little
to you
bit?
In a way?
I mean, look, I get it. I understand the comparisons. I think they're entirely different stories. That's my opinion. I'm not suggesting I'm right. I think they both can exist. I think they both can both do well. I think one can do well, one can do poorly. I think there's any number of things that can happen that are non-correlated, in my opinion, between the two. With that said, if crypto didn't exist, I think, which is now what? The market cap of crypto is probably north of a trillion and a half. I don't know. What is it?
But Bitcoin is $1.4 trillion, right?
$1.4 trillion. Yeah. There you go. So if you say a third of that would have made its way into the gold market, half of that, I mean, yeah, that would have been significant for the gold market. It's not. I get it. But to your point, yeah, I think gold, people don't want to talk about it for whatever reason. They want to focus on Bitcoin. I think there's a story here in gold. Anyway, Dan.
All right, fair enough. Hey, so we appreciate all the questions. We got a question from Scott A. We're going to hit that tomorrow. It's on Adobe. Carter's going to be bragging for us. They report after the close tomorrow. We started talking about it earlier in the week, but we'll do a much deeper dive on Adobe. So Scott A., thanks for the question. Thanks for all the great questions there, people.
Thanks, people, for joining. Sorry I was late. You never know, New York City. Tunnels, which I explained. But we will be back tomorrow. If it's Thursday, it's what?
Butters.
Bitch, yes. And we'll have Carter Braxton Worth. We'll see you.
First of all, I mean, just really quickly.
Rangers won last night.
There you go.
Yeah, I knew what you were
thinking
about.
Three in a row like that. You like that. You're
well, I mean,
that?
Last night was a playoff hockey game. They played in Carolina, yes, having played
and
the night
before.
They
said they're going to have to go down there and do a job, and they did a job.
And they did. Yeah. And I'll tell you, if you were watching and or listening to that game, if you close your eyes like, holy shit, the Rangers, this is a home game.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of Ranger fans, that, which makes sense, a lot of plants.
Yeah.
But with that said, the Rangers played it. And I tell you what, Adam Fox played as well as he's played all year. And Kyandre Miller, who you know, I think he's starting to really figure it out, which is huge with obviously Jacob Trouba hurt for the next couple of weeks. And what you're seeing is Zach Jones can play in this league. Dan is like, okay, I'm done.
By the way,
for many of you who
might have been wondering, Liz and I went to the Ranger game what night did we go?
Monday.
On Monday night. And we were walking out to get a beer between the first and the second period. And who do we see? Stephan Matteau. They were playing the Devils.
Yeah.
Okay. So Stephan Matteau scored in double overtime, game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals to send the Rangers to the Stanley Cup Finals, where they beat the
Vancouver Canucks. Yeah. Now, what was interesting about that game,
but listen, really quickly, guy, literally, we just happened to be standing right near where in the garden they have the big plaque. They had his skates.
Tribute.
And we took a picture. Yeah, it was amazing.
Well, so you know, outside of the Pete Stemkowski goal, as you remember, Dan, that's the most famous goal in Ranger history.
Matoma.
Say this. It was a Friday night, that game, ahead of Memorial Day.
You remember where you were?
I do. I was driving to the beach listening to the game on the radio. I got to the house that we rented. I don't want to say our beach house because that would sound – I don't own a beach house. Yeah. We rented a house with like six other people. Nobody was home. The television was the size of this computer screen.
Right.
And by myself, I was sitting there watching this game. Now, as you also remember, the Rangers were winning that game. The Devils scored with like 9 seconds left. And every effing Ranger fan in existence, like, oh my God, I can't believe this is about to happen. They're going to beat us in overtime. And I will tell you that overtime, there are a couple times where the Devil wide open nets that they missed. I don't want to say what was in your mouth, but trust me, they were, because I was terrified. Then, of course, Mateau scores that goal. And it's interesting, you know, if you listen to the not the replay of the game, but the broadcast of the game, one of the commentators, I don't remember who it was, said, it looks like Mateau's got really fresh legs here.
Yeah.
30 seconds later. Wraps around
that
scores
thing in there, and it's it was great.
Well, and you know for a second or two, you didn't know if that puck was in the net, and then the place just erupted.
And by the way, so last year we were at a game and you got to meet Mateau, Messier, and Richter, and that was, you were like a kid in a candy
not
stand.
Really.
I mean, I was standing there, you were standing there, but I knew deep down inside, You thought that was about as cool as it gets. That's what I meant. You're pretty happy.
Yeah, I was happy that they won that night, I believe. I was actually one of the – and, you know, the people that go to games and lounge around these boxes
– it's not for you.
No.
Well, it wasn't us. It was.
It's not my
thing. All right. You know what? I take that. I didn't mean it like you were like all giddy. Like
I don't get like giddy.
I know, but my point is me knowing you well enough.
No,
there's a few people
– I'll tell you what we did do. So Messier walked into the box, probably the second period between whatever.
Yeah.
And the box is open. So right below you, there are actually people in seats watching games. And it was clear that a couple of people in front of us noticed that Messier, and it created a bit of a stir around us. So there was a kid in these seats that was like, had his Ranger jersey on. So we lifted this kid up, brought him up into the box, took a picture with Messier. And then think about that for that kid. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
And we were there for a fundraiser. It was raising for a foundation. Yeah. So it was all cool, but it was fun to meet those guys. And
Amanda's not even with us. She's
gone. Left. All right. Well, that was fun. We covered that. So the Rangers, I mean, three in a row. I mean, how about
They're playing good hockey.
Yeah.
I think now they've reached a 90-point mark. They're closing in on the most points in the league. Florida, I think, has 94, but Florida's played one more game, I believe. So there's a chance, not that it means a damn thing, but the President's Trophy is given to the team in the regular season that has the most points.
Yep.
So right now it's Florida. I think Vancouver's in the mix, maybe Winnipeg. I think the Rangers, obviously, and I mentioned Florida. So, you know, and the Bruins are probably in there as well. So you got five teams vying for this.
Yeah.
It means shit. It
doesn't mean
because the Bruins won it last year.
Cup
the friggin' won. Bruins won it. They could have stopped playing now.
Yep.
With 20 games left, they would have won it. They get blown out. They get losing the first round to Florida. Right, I tell you, NHL playoffs, a whole different kettle of fish.
Whole different kettle. All right, tomorrow we got Butters.
Dan is like, and Butters,
and,
bitch.
And we have Carter back with us, so that is going to be fun. All right, so we'll see you all tomorrow. Thanks so much for being here. Bye.